authoritarian regime had built. That is the only constituency they have. And that is very important because it explains the lack of popularity with respect to Burhan on the part of the Sudanese population. On the other hand, Hemeti not only does not have a constituency among the Sudanese population, but at the moment he's using his militias in street battles where he's using the Sudanese population essentially as human shields because of the kind of strategies he needs to utilize, absent having a strategic weapons, including airplanes or fighter jets. He has to resort, and he's resorting to these street battles in order to generate a military victory in the capital of Khartoum. So it's very important to understand that both have very narrow constituencies.
Professor Madani, in a moment, we're also going to be joined by Jan Eglin to talk about the humanitarian activities in the area of non-governmental organizations and what they're able to do in Sudan. But I wanted to ask about your own family. You're trying to get your mother out. Are you able to reach her?
Thank you for asking. Thank you. Like thousands of Sudanese, she is hopefully on the road from Khartoum. It's not only my mother, but my aunts, my uncles, my cousins. They have taken several buses. Like all Sudanese, we have relatives throughout the capital city, not just one neighborhood. Unfortunately, the communication is very patchy, and that's why your guest was not able to make it. It's a great concern. For all Sudanese, it's a very long trip, very arduous. There are checkpoints. And the decision to leave is really based on basically the evaporation of any other kind of option. No one wants to leave their home, but it's not just about the shelling. It is also about, as your news reporting demonstrated, I think people need to be aware that people are completely running out of water and food. And also, there are absolutely no medicines. So there is absolutely no choice except to leave the capital city and find refuge elsewhere. It is absolutely understandable that the international community and the foreign countries have evacuated their citizens and essential staff, and hopefully they'll evacuate Sudanese citizens from their country. At the same time, this is signaling an abdication of the international community's responsibility, not only to the transitioning Sudan to a democracy, but the real concern here is that the depth of the humanitarian crisis will not be addressed. The international community will not have the will to actually intervene. And I think that that is the most crucial at the moment. I think they can. There are many pressure points that they can apply. I would even argue, because of the actors that have supported these generals, that selective sanctions, and this is something that even the Congress has been deliberating upon, selective targeted sanctions towards them. I believe very sincerely, if it's a concerted, coordinated effort on the part of the international community, can work. Importantly and finally, it's very important to emphasize that neighboring countries have to be encouraged to maintain their open borders and to be supported in that. It is, of course, a great burden for countries, no matter how generous they may be, to take fleeing, displaced persons and refugees. But that can be alleviated by Jan Eglin and others and the United Nations. And that has been done before in what we call complex humanitarian emergencies. And I believe that that is really important to emphasize. It's very possible, hopefully, even though most foreigners have evacuated their citizens, this does not signal abdicating a responsibility for Sudan. I would argue that it's not only humanitarian for those in the different capitals, in the neighboring countries and the regional blocs, but also far further afield in the United States. This is a country whose stability is crucial to the stability of the Horn of Africa, the Red Sea, Indian Ocean, the Sahel region, and throughout North Africa. It is the third largest country in the continent. I think that is something that must be highlighted and reiterated to the international community.
Well, Khalid Mustafa Madani, we want to thank you so much for being with us. You mentioned Jan. We also have him on the line with us from Washington. He's just back, actually, from Honduras, but is also dealing with what's happening in Sudan. As we look at how virtually all all humanitarian work has been paralyzed in Sudan. The Norwegian Refugee Council says the, quote, worst-case scenario is unfolding because they're unable to provide assistance amid such heavy fighting. We are joined by the NRC Secretary General Jan Egeland. If you can lay out the humanitarian situation right now in Sudan that you and other NGOs are facing. If you could start again, I just haven't heard the beginning of what you said. I'm not sure if anyone else is hearing, but I am not hearing you. I think you are muted. We will try. You know, we're going to go to... Oh, hi, I think we can hear you now. We can't. So we're going to go to break, and then we're going to come back. We'll fix this issue. I wish we could. I wish the issue in Sudan could be fixed as easily. Khalid Mustafa Madani, we want to thank you for being with us. Sudanese scholar, chair of the African Studies Program at McGill University, speaking to us from Montreal. We'll be back with Jan Egeland in a minute.
I think of all the people I keep beside me, the ones who came before and fell underneath, the ones I know who watch over me. I think of all the people here on my journey, how they help bring out new parts of me. When I accept my duality,
this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on Sudan, virtually all humanitarian work paralyzed as these militaries fight each other and the civilians are in the crossfire. Hundreds have died. The Norwegian Refugee Council saying it's the worst-case scenario that's unfolding because they're unable to provide assistance amidst such heavy fighting. Hopefully, we have on the line with us right now the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council called—he is Jan Egeland. If you can lay out—we're hoping we have your sound right now—lay out the humanitarian situation in Sudan. We don't have you, I am sorry to say. We don't hear you. We were hoping we could get you on the phone. It looks like we weren't able to do that. We're going to see if we could get you on by the end of the show, but we're going to move on to another top story in the United States right now and hopefully get back to Jan Eglin by the end of the broadcast. Yes, this is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we are now turning to the U.S. Supreme Court decision, that closely watched decision where the Supreme Court Friday halted a ban and other restrictions on the abortion medication mifepristone on Friday, keeping the nation's most popular abortion method available for now as an appeal of the nationwide ban on the pill plays out. The ban was issued earlier this month by the Trump-appointed right-wing judge Matthew Kaczmarek of Texas, who ruled the FDA's 23-year-old approval of mifepristone was invalid. Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas were the only ones to dissent in the 7-2 ruling. The case is still likely to end up in front of the Supreme Court after making its way through a lower appeals court. This has led to mounting calls to restructure the nation's highest court. On Friday, New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, quote, "The court has devolved into a highly politicized entity that is rapidly delegitimizing. Open discussion of checking the court's abuse of power and defying Kaczmarek possibly contributed to pause consideration." AOC and others had called on the federal government to defy the Texas judge's order. Arguments in the challenge to the mifepristone ban are scheduled for May 17th. For more, we go to Mary Ziegler, the Martin Luther King Professor of Law at the University of California, Davis, author of 6 books, including Roe, The History of a National Obsession, and Dollars for Life, the Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. Her new piece for The Atlantic is headlined, "The Justices Pass on an Abortion Pill Ban Until They Hear a Better Case." Welcome back, Professor Ziegler, to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Explain what you mean. Talk about the significance of the Supreme Court ruling on Friday.
Well, the significance on the ground is hard to underestimate because, of course, this means that people will have access to this pill, mifepristone, on the same terms they did before this litigation began. But we don't want to read too much into it either. This is what's considered a shadow docket ruling, meaning there was no oral argument, meaning we don't really know why the majority of the justices did what they did. And of course, it's early in the litigation. But I think most of us are probably correct to assume that this doesn't bode well for the anti-abortion groups that are the plaintiffs in this suit. 7 of the justices sided with the FDA, and that's a preview of what they think of the merits of the case. But that doesn't mean that this Supreme Court is generally any less hostile to abortion or any less conservative than was the case before. Most likely, it just means that this was a lousy case. There were real questions about whether these plaintiffs had standing to sue. They brought this case 23 years after the FDA approved mifepristone, so there were questions about whether it was a timely lawsuit. And so it may just be that no matter how conservative the justices are, they thought this case is procedurally so flawed that we can't sign off on it. But there are lots of anti-abortion lawsuits in the pipeline because anti-abortion lawyers understand how conservative the Supreme Court is right now.
So if you can explain, you had Alito and Clarence Thomas dissenting. Explain what that meant and what it signifies for the future. And of course, I mean, you have this Supreme Court that's completely bogged down other ways as well. And the serious questions being asked about Clarence Thomas, if you think that weighed in, and this isn't separate from, I mean, that would be levels of corruption, not reporting financial support from this billionaire donor. It's not separate from this story because he's deeply tied to Leonard Leo. Leonard Leo, who was key to getting Kaczmarek seated as a Trump appointee, a judge in Amarillo, Texas.
Yeah, I mean, the dissent, again, I think was bad news for these anti-abortion plaintiffs in the sense that we don't know why Thomas dissented. He just dissented. He didn't explain what he was doing. Alito dissented essentially to say, Not that he thought that the plaintiffs had standing to sue, not that he thought that the FDA didn't have authority to approve mifepristone, not to allude to this 19th century anti-vice law called the Comstock Act, but basically to say, I don't think the FDA is going to suffer any harm here because I don't think the FDA would basically enforce any order against mifepristone anyway, because the FDA thinks mifepristone is safe and effective. So essentially saying the FDA is either going to use its discretion to ignore anything we say, or the FDA is going to be somehow kind of lawless, which was a weird thing to write. But again, bad news for the plaintiffs, because even Justice Alito wasn't taking the time to express any kind of sympathy for any of the plaintiffs' arguments about mifepristone itself, right? In terms of whether Clarence Thomas's ongoing scandals had anything to do with this, I'd be a little skeptical of that. I mean, it may be that some of the justices who are now considered the ones holding deciding votes, like Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, maybe they're concerned with the court as an institution and the perceived legitimacy of the court. But I think there are some signs that a lot of the justices on this court are not concerned with the court's legitimacy, don't see themselves as stewards of the institution. I certainly think that's true of Thomas, who at various points has sort of presented himself in very populist terms as sort of an outsider who's opposed to institutions, not someone like Chief Justice John Roberts, who, for all that he's very conservative, does seem very anxious about perceptions of the court. Some of the other members of the current conservative majority don't seem to share those concerns. And so it would surprise me, for example, if, you know, someone like Neil Gorsuch, who joined the opinion staying the Fifth Circuit's ruling, if he was concerned about what's going on with Clarence Thomas. I think it may be more that even within the conservative legal community, there are a lot of sort of pet arguments that people like Leonard Leo have cultivated over the years. And those include arguments about standing. And these plaintiffs, I just don't think, had standing. But I don't know if this augurs a sort of broader shift in the court or broader concern about the legitimacy of the court that might slow down some of the really revolutionary changes the court is making in jurisprudence across the board, not just, of course, when it comes to abortion.
Do you think the Supreme Court is aware of the effect it's having, for example, even on the elections to come, and how deeply unpopular these decisions around abortion are, that across the political spectrum, the vast majority of Americans are against an abortion ban?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, so do I think they're aware? Absolutely. I mean, these are intelligent people. The question is more, do they care, right? And there's sort of different ways you could view the role of a deeply conservative justice, right? You could see yourself as a sort of partisan soldier. So you could see your role as being to facilitate, in part, outcomes that the Republican Party is invested in, or not, right? You could see your role as being faithful to some kind of ideology or interpretive set of commitments that have nothing to do with the GOP or nothing to do with the people who nominated you. And I think at least some of the justices, and this was very clear in Justice Alito's opinion in the Dobbs case last summer, essentially Justice Alito says, you know, people are raising the idea that this opinion will damage our legitimacy. And one, I don't know if that's true, but two, and more importantly, if it is true, we shouldn't care about that, because the court's legitimacy and the public perception of the court is not our job. And I think there are a number of conservative justices who really feel that way, that when they're doing things that are unpopular, that's really none of anyone else's concern. Of course, that puts the court in some tension with the Republican leadership, because the Republican leadership wants to be able to cut its own path when it comes to abortion and not be pushed into defending things like nationwide bans from the 19th century that the courts are bringing to the fore, right? That people like Judge Kaczmarek and the Fifth Circuit are going to bring to the fore. And I think we're going to continue to see that, at least from the Fifth Circuit, in as the Fifth Circuit continues to look at this case in May. And it may well be that the Supreme Court takes that up as well. But I don't know, right? I don't know if the Supreme Court cares about its effect on elections or not. My guess is no.
And Professor Ziegler, where the access to the abortion pill, the majority of Americans who, the majority of people who use this, who get abortions, use the abortion pill, its access right now?
Right now, it's the same it's been before this litigation began. So if you are in a blue state that has no restrictions or bans on abortion, you can get access to this pill via telehealth up to the 10th week of pregnancy. If you're in a state that's criminalized abortion, of course, this outcome hasn't changed that. You're not able to get access to the pill in your state. You would have to travel to a different state or use something like aid access. And so nothing has changed at the national level. But I think this suit and I think the references to the Comstock Act make clear that people who are in progressive states can't be complacent in the sense of assuming that their access to abortion will be determined by their state governments, because this is one of a series of suits that are trying to take the question out of the hands of voters and lawmakers in progressive states, essentially to kind of nationalize outcomes via the federal courts.
Well, we want to thank you, Mary Ziegler, for joining us. Martin Luther King Professor of Law at University of California, Davis. We'll link to your piece in The Atlantic, The Justices Pass on an Abortion Pill Ban Until They Hear a Better Case. We're going to go to a 30-second break, then hopefully we'll be able to connect with the Norwegian Refugee Council about Sudan and Honduras. Stay with us.
Somewhere in Germany, but I can't place it. Man, I hate this part of Texas. Close my eyes, fantasize. Three clicks and I'm home. When I get back, I'll lay around. Then I'll get up and lay back down. Romanticize a quiet life. There's no place like my room. But you had to go.
This is Democracy Now!, Phoebe Bridgers singing I Know the End. This is democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we end today's show with Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, just back from Honduras. But before we go to Honduras, we want to talk about what's happening in Sudan. You are the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Can you talk about the level of humanitarian support, if there is any, in Sudan right now as these militaries fight each other and kill the civilians in the crossfire?
Well, at the moment, Amy, there is hardly any humanitarian work in large parts of Sudan, which was a place in deep humanitarian crisis before this senseless intramilitary battle that has engulfed nearly all of the cities, nearly all of the regions. However, I think the story is too much now. Let's evacuate all of the diplomats. Let's evacuate all of the internationals. What will be the role of the Wagner Group and so on? I think the real story is that millions of Sudanese are now in a free fall, and those who are worse off are the millions of internally displaced people and the refugees. And that's why we and the Norwegian Refugee Council and all of our peer organizations are now planning how to resume work as soon as there is a pause in the fighting.
And of course, there's been a ceasefire put in place, one attempted ceasefire, but the militaries don't honor it. Are you dealing with these leaders, the military leaders of the country?
Well, I've reached out to those UN envoys who have contact with them. We will also use whatever contacts we can via countries who deal with them, because we need to get to them that this war will—it's really a war now. It will be impossible to stop if it lasts for much longer. We still have an opportunity to have a real a ceasefire. If they lose completely control over the fighters, as they are in some areas, this will be a nightmare beyond belief.
We're going to switch gears now from Sudan to Honduras, where you've just returned from, Jan Egeland. If you can talk about the situation on the ground there, what you're concerned with most, and the call by U.S. Senators Chris Van Hollen, Ben Cardin, Tim Kaine, Congressmember Joaquin Castro, who sent a letter to the Biden administration calling for the president to continue to protect Salvadorans and Hondurans with temporary protected status, or TPS, connect all these issues.
Well, and that's a very important letter, really. And for the North Americans, it's important to realize that in your neighborhood, there are warlike conditions. I've been now three times to Central America, crisscrossing many of the countries. I was in Honduras in recent days. The thousands and thousands of families in the middle of the crossfire between armed groups, drugs cartels, heavily armed gangs, these people are in the same situation as the Sudanese, or if you like, the Ukrainians or the Syrians, that get much more of the attention. So the reason people are moving north is that there is no security for them in Central America. There is no hope for a better future. So what we have to do and what we can do as organizations on the ground with resources from North America, but also from Europe and Gulf countries and so on, is to provide humanitarian protection, education, livelihoods, so that there is hope for a better future there. At the same time, as of course North America needs to honor the legitimate asylum applications for protection of people from your own neighborhood.
And can you explain why humanitarian funding in Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador has been reduced to some of the lowest globally during this crisis and the effect this has, and particularly talk about the effect of U.S. immigration policy?
Well, indeed, it's utterly underfunded, our humanitarian programming in Central America. One-third of the population needs humanitarian relief on levels of what you would have in other places, even in Africa, in terms of needs. There is one big donor, and that's the United States. So where is Europe? Where is the Gulf countries? Where are the larger Asian economies? We need to wake up all of the donor nations for this crisis, which is driven by immense violence against women, children, families, climate change, which is hitting this region so hard, but also in poverty in general. So I was in school, just one example, in La Lima, Honduras. They had 5,000 students in this secondary school 5 years ago. Now there is 1,200, a reduction of 4,000. And I ask why? Because there is too much fear to go to school for violence. And thousands had been walking north. There were several students on their way north at this moment. So indeed, there has to be a real investment in hope in Central America. If not, this will just continue and continue.
Jan Egeland, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council in Washington, D.C. this week. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Sanji Lopez, and Dennis Moynihan. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley and John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. If you want to see transcripts of our show and all our past shows, you can get video and audio podcasts. Go to democracynow.org, where you can also sign up for our daily digest each day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land. Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.